Art Supply Posse. I find myself once again surprised that the newest member of the Art Supply Posse, today's guest, James Hillier, better known as Nordacious, graciously agreed to chat with me. After all, he has worked with Disney Plus here in Australia, Lionsgate, had his work exhibited across Australia, and even had a piece of his artwork selected as the official CD cover for a remix of Hold Me Closer by Elton John and Britney Spears. Yet, he has managed to make some time for us joining me for a conversation, of which I am so, so grateful for. Hello, James. Welcome to the Art Supply Posse.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
My absolute pleasure. I mentioned this to you, James, in my initial contact, but I've been following your work for quite a while, and I don't even know how it came into my orbit. I just genuinely cannot remember, but somehow it did, and I'm so, so grateful for it. What I want to do, though, is usually when I start a conversation with an artist, I typically do the thing of, you know, asking them about their first childhood artistic memory or what drew you to art or whatever, which we will get to. But I have a question which actually relates to something a bit more recent, and it surprised me when I first learnt about it, which is why I want to ask you, which is quite a big build-up, I realise, for something that's like not – I'm not asking for your personal details, but you recently – you and your partner recently opened up a bricks and mortar store, which is such, it feels like a big thing to do in this day and age. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about that. Like, why did you make the decision to do that?
Gosh, yeah, it does still sometimes feel surreal because it's a little store that's literally on the same street where we live. So it's super convenient. And it's on this little corner block that's this old 1950s precinct. We both adore mid-century modern architecture. So the refab that they'd done was just beautiful. There was breeze blocks, palm trees, lots of butterfly roofs and all of that. So it's charming as hell. And we'd sort of casually been on our dream list to have a shared space because my partner Aaron, otherwise known as a boy named Aaron, he's a visual artist too. He's been doing it for about 15 years now. It was just on the cards for us one day. It would be amazing to have a joint physical space. And it just so happened that, yeah, the little corner shop was getting a redo and we saw the listing online and just thought we'd jump on it.
It is a big jump though, because like it's one thing to have a shared space for the two of you to work, but it would be another, I'd imagine, to also have that, like, you're selling products. That's not just a studio, it's an actual studio and a store. Like, was that I imagine you didn't have plans for that, but what made you go from simply wanting a shared studio space to having actually we want to sell product, we want to sell things to people?
I mean, we're both huge lovers of interior design as well as visual arts. It all beautifully overlaps for us. We're very visual people. And so it really makes sense to be able to have the opportunity to contextualize what we do inside a physical space that people come into. We present a lot of like gallery wall clusters and we have a lot of home furnishings inside the store that complements our art range. We're partnered with artists from Mexico and Colombia as well. So it's a very eclectic explosion of color. And so for us, it was important that we could create a really visually striking, borderline overwhelming experience for the person walking in. We're next to a little cafe. So quite often we have, you know, looky-loos coming through, you know, with their little coffee cups and they're all caffeinated and ready for some window shopping. So we like to think it really is a nice complementary business to our little bustling neighborhood corner. And it's a beautiful opportunity for us just to contextualize what we do in a physical space and introduce other stuff as well that complements our range as well.
Yeah, well, but I guess because you sell product online as well, so I suppose, I mean, it's an extension of that, but it must also feel different. Like people browsing a store as opposed to an online store? Like, he was, I guess the thing about having a store is, does it give you more product you can sell, I guess, because you don't have that thing of having to deal with postage costs and, you know, what goes on with postage. But also, do you find you're engaging with people more because they're coming into the store, or is this, are the store people a different audience to your online audience?
Yeah, very much a mixed bag. We're both pretty introverted people, so it's really forced us to be a bit more social and outgoing. But it's been a lovely opportunity to meet the community. And yeah, we get all sorts that come in, people who have no idea who we are. Sometimes we get people coming in who do know who we are, but had no idea our shop was here, and they walk in and they quickly join the dots. Having the physical space has certainly allowed us to have all sorts of stuff, like stuff that's a lot more fragile that people can just take away for themselves, like a lot of glass work and more fragile things, as well as bigger things that most people probably wouldn't want to splurge on the shipping for, like your big floor lamps and stuff like that. So it's been nice to be able to incorporate, yeah, some more variety in the line.
So are you then, like, let's say tomorrow you wake up and decide to create a new design. Do you now have the ability to go, well, hang on a minute, I actually want to see that on a lampshade? And so you can design with a product in mind, or is it like, is it not quite as straightforward as that? Does the design come and then you consider where it would fit, as in, you know, for the...
Yeah, I don't always typically design a piece with an end use in mind specifically. I tend to just, the piece just comes to me and I just really want to put it out there and just see how it lands and how people want to purchase it. But certainly, like, sometimes on some smaller stuff, I could even use the shop as like a little, you know, science lab or a test, a running show, you know, to see what the people, what the punters actually respond to in real time in person before I may even post it online and see how the response is there. So it's interesting in that context too.
Yeah, definitely. I guess you got, actually got me to thinking about the actual artwork itself. Because I should, one of us should actually tell the listeners, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, oh my goodness, we haven't even talked. I went straight to the storefront, not even talking about what your actual artwork is. So how about instead of me summarizing what I've learned, yeah, and certainly what I think, right? Because of course we all interpret art differently.
Yes. Yeah.
How would you describe your artwork to somebody?
Well, it started off as pointillism illustration with a focus on portraiture. So pointillism, for those who don't know, it's the process of, you know, hundreds of thousands of tiny little fine liner ink dots to build up texture and shadow. And I use that a lot in portraiture, which I then developed into mixed media pieces where I'd incorporate a digital brush for color over the top and compose it like in Photoshop. These days, I tend to stick more to just the digital brush. So I illustrate exclusively in Procreate on iPad with an Apple Pencil, and then upload it to Photoshop to do some tweaks. But the work itself is pop art with you know, pop cultural references. I do a lot of social political commentary as well, plus a lot of like corporate work, private commissioned work, family portraits, pet portraits, event posters, touring posters, all that sort of stuff as well. So there's sort of an overlap of graphic design as well. But these days, yeah, it's mostly just the digital brush pop art. It's very vibrant. It does have a bit of a retro aesthetic too. I like to... I'm really interested in the overlap of digital with the analog. So incorporating a lot of halftone textures, vintage retro distress textures over the top of flattened color areas. I just kind of like how that reads when in the final product. So yeah, that's probably a really long-winded answer, but that's essentially what I'm
doing.
No.
There's a lot, also a lot of color, like a lot of it's bold color, but definitely, like, that's, I think, probably what I noticed first was the strong use of color. Like, it appears that you're not afraid of colour, which is fantastic.
Absolutely not.
to be fair, what's fascinating though, when you mentioned that you and your partner are both quite introverted, I don't see that when I look at the work. And that's really funny because I guess when you look at something, you're always assuming, you know, you're trying to read the artist and understand why they're doing what they do. And so when you're seeing all your colour, I'm like, well, he must be. And also, I guess, like reading the commentary and you know, what slogans and stuff you've used, for example, I'm like, well, of course he must be. He must be an extrovert and he must be like the centre stage kind of thing. And yet you're telling me that's not the case. And I find that so fascinating that we assume something based on very little, really.
I think it's the art really speaks for itself, and it sort of has given me that boldness to celebrate the things I wouldn't have so openly wanted to in the past, and to speak up on issues I probably wouldn't have raised my voice on in the past. It's the art and the creativity that helps me find that confidence, I suppose, and that audacity to put out some bold ideas or stuff that's going to start some conversations or ruffle some feathers. So, yeah, I've always been quite introverted as a person, but I feel the art is sort of that alter ego almost, where it's a lot more wild. Yeah.
It makes sense. And I guess the art, I was going to say the art's doing the work. That's not quite right. But like the art is, right? Like it is speaking for you. It makes sense. So I want to know though, because a lot of your art is both the illustration, whether it's a portrait or whatnot of somebody. I'm thinking of the works that we see a lot, which is, you know, somebody famous, like Dolly Parton is the one that come to my head.
Yeah.
But then you also have a quotation typically alongside that. What comes first?
Oh, good question. Not necessarily either.
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes it may just be a case of I just want to delve into this particular character. Other times it might be it's been something that's really topical and it's just happened in the news and it's the quote that's really cutting through and I think it says something interesting or important and I'll just latch on the quote and everything else sort of works around the quote. So honestly, it's a bit of both, to be honest.
Yeah, and I must admit, I do like that. There is such a variety, like it's almost like, and I guess, you know, you're explaining that you do other work, you know, commissions and private work. And
so,
like it makes sense that there is a lot of different things that encompasses your work, yet everything I've seen feels like it's you, if that makes sense.
Good. Yeah, I do. Oh, I certainly, I mean, most creatives are probably like to hope that, you know, their work feels cohesive yet still diverse as well. I really enjoy being able to jump from celebrating the good stuff to raging at the crap stuff as well, just balancing it out, the rage and the joy. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you manage? Because I'm imagining for the content that is related to current things happening in the world, you know, current, whether it's, and it's not all, I should point out to the listeners, it's not all Australia only. We know we have there's a lot of world will do for, you know, a bigger sort of bigger idea. But how do you manage, because I'm imagining you having to be online enough to at least find out what's going on in the zeitgeist, right? Like, who are we raging at or who are we cheering? Because, of course, that's also the other option, the other possibility. Mm. How do you manage your, you know what, I'm going to say it, how do you manage maintaining a good level of mental health when you do have to be involved online?
Yeah. Oh, it's a delicate dance, particularly with the political stuff, obviously. If I'm going to be making commentary about that, using satire as a device, it's so important to me that I get the context and the nuance and the details right. And so I often feel that obligation to, particularly when you're dealing with some really heavy, complex issues, to hit the mark right. It can be a very delicate process trying to hit all the right notes in the way that you intend and to land broadly in the way that you hope that it does. And so you're often mentally in those spaces where you are delving through some really gnarly stuff that's quite heavy. And that for me is really difficult. I've always felt things quite deeply. I think that's part of why I want to speak out about things too. But on the flip side, being able to channel and focus that rage or that despair, or that point of view into the work, it is a very cathartic process too, even though it can be like quite emotionally taxing. But of course as well, like then being able to publish it online and seeing how it lands with the community that you've built, and just to see it resonating, or someone adds in something that you haven't thought of before, or there's always this really valuable, interesting feedback. That all makes it so positive too, and it's been wonderful, particularly during the last 2 or 3 years when things have been feeling increasingly insane and volatile globally, to have that human connection on the other side of people going, yeah, you're not going insane. Like, this is how we're feeling too, and we totally empathize with your perspective. And so that has been wonderfully cathartic too, to have that community and to be able to feel that solidarity with other people as well. So it's a mixed bag.
yeah, I can imagine. So do you have some kind of outlet that actually has nothing to do with art? Like, do you clock off it every day and, I don't know, go for a jog, or like what is I don't know why I said that, because I am not a runner, but, you know, it's apparently
I'm trying to get maybe 10K steps in every day, but yeah, not quite.
God, no.
I mean, I'm a bit of a night owl, so, I mean, we get up early anyway, well, early being like 8 o'clock to open up the shop, but I'm typically drawing into the night. My extracurricular activities probably involve a nap during the middle of the day. Being a full-time dog dad, I'm obsessed with dogs, and I try and get to the gym every now and then too, but we try and decompress. We are a bit of a workaholic kind of family, but when you are a creative too and you are doing something that you love, it sort of does blur the lines a little bit anyway, so it never feels like you're truly clocked off.
Yeah. So how did James come to art in the first place? Like, when did that start for you?
As early as I can remember, really, I've always just loved faces. I love portraiture. I've been fascinated by people storytelling on their face and capturing likeness or essence of someone. So, I mean, from a young age, it started, like, you know, with your Disney characters, typically villains. I once published my own little, like, it's like stapling together these, like, 60 pages or
that's
something.
That's publishing. Colored in pictures. Yeah.
Published in my household.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'd go to primary school and I started drawing teachers and friends, and I noticed that I was getting some attention for it. And that felt really nice, because I was that really awkward introverted child who I think I did struggle a bit socially, because I was so introverted and insular. Doing the creative stuff gave me a little bit of confidence. So from there, I kept on at it. I dabbled with paints, pastels, graphite, and then by the time I got to high school, I took on art classes as well, which was amazing. And then from there, university, doing comm design stuff, and found myself in a career doing graphic design, and then that eventually led into doing the full-time visual art gig. So, yeah.
Yeah, nice. It's one of those things, isn't it, with, excuse me, art, because it gives you, well, I guess it has certainly given you a voice that you may not have had beforehand, but it also, it just gives us, it rewards us in ways that are kind of hard to describe. Like, even when you're in the middle of creating something, and oh, this is me, I guess I'm not trying to talk for you, but like, it sometimes feels like, why am I doing this? This is the silliest idea I've ever had. Like, you know, when it's not working out or whatever. And then when you get it and it's done, that sense of pride and joy and achievement I don't know. It's kind of unique and isn't like, I don't think it's like anything else anyway.
Hmm. Well, my parents have always been really hands-on creative people as well, and they sort of instilled that from a young age, the value in making and doing and building stuff tangibly with your own hands and the sense of accomplishment it can give you. And my mum, all the time, she's always like, you know, it's evolutionary. Like, we started hunter-gatherers and then everything we did with our hands. And for some people, it's becoming a lost art, like the disciplines and the skills of applying ourselves in those sort of ways. And being able to tap into that, it truly, like, whether you're just making a cake or something, or whether you're just into cleaning, like doing that sort of action physically, I don't know, does something to the brain. And then the sense of accomplishment when you've, you know, I've birthed this little baby of creativity. It does something in the brain, which I think is really, really, really good mentally.
Yeah. And I kind of feel a little bad saying this because a lot of your work is so digital, but like it's also really nice to create something when you're not using a screen. That's
For sure. Yeah.
That's one of the things that I think.
Down to the shop and just sketch. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. 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 There's just something about it. I don't know what it is, that hand eye thing, and just doesn't even matter. And you're right. It literally can, even the achievement of cleaning. You know, a room.
I just got a steam mop earlier today, so it's on my brain.
Awesome.
Getting off on just seeing like grime come off the hardwood floors, and that's the most exciting thing that's happened today, except for this, obviously. So,
I am with you. I'm with you on that as someone who uses a steam cleaner and cleaned my bathroom yesterday. Yeah, I'm here for it.
Yeah.
So, when you collaborate with somebody else for a piece, whether that's a private client when you collaborate with a private person as opposed to a company, is it different? Like, is the input from each more or less harder, easier to deal with? Like, what is that like actually collaborating with somebody else?
I'm probably going to give a really boring nothing answer because it is each circumstance is so specifically unique. And sometimes you'll get a private client who wants you to do a portrait of their animal that's just passed, and they'll be incredibly pedantic and want very specific things and give you lots of feedback around it. And that's fine. I aim to please. And inversely, you could get a huge corporation where there's 1,000 cooks in the kitchen and stuff, and surprisingly, it just sweeps straight through and just gets approved. And then again, you could get another personal client, and they just like say, I trust your creativity and your vision. I'm not a creative person. This is just what I want. Go away and I'll be happy with whatever you do. And I'm like, beauty, like excellent. Inversely again, you get a corporation and it's suddenly, you know, Susan from accounts has something to say and Bob from admin also wants to put his 2 cents in. It's like, wow. That's,
you know. Yeah, no. So if I was to click my fingers and make it happen, would be your dream person, people to collaborate with?
Good. Oh, there's so many. I mean, at the moment, for the last 2 years, I always thought it'd be pretty cool to do something with Chapel Roan, just because she is such a visual artist with her music. And, you know, she's someone who's a bit out of the box, and she's obviously very visually striking and unapologetically bold and edgy and unique. So that's definitely one that comes to mind for now.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I mean, I wish I could make it happen.
I thought you were about to say, yeah, I'll just pick up the phone and yeah.
On the flip side of that, have you ever had to turn down a commission because it just hasn't interested you? Not time-wise, like not I'm just too busy, I can't do anything, but rather, which I don't know, maybe it would never happen, it seems, given your work is so politically rooted and you know, in current events. I'm imagining you're not going to get a commission from the Liberal Party, for example. although I guess you never know. But, like, has there ever been a time where you've just gone, no, it's just not going to work?
Yeah, definitely. And, I mean, that's also been a product of as time has gone on and my work has been becoming more increasingly politically charged and nuanced, integrity is really important to me. And if I'm doing something that's associated with someone that is completely ethically, morally repulsive to me or at odds, like I won't take the paycheck.
Yeah.
Revolting. So yeah, there's been, and I'm not saying that ones I've turned down the past have all been like,
no,
or anything like that. But sometimes you just know as well, or the scope of the job itself may not be quite up my creative alley. And like, as I said before, like I aim to please and I want to do a really good job for a client. And I feel like, oh, this kind of thing they're wanting from me, it's just not my bag. Like, I don't think I'd really kick butt. I wouldn't really nail that brief for them. I'll sometimes just say, yes, thanks, but no thanks. So, yeah.
I think it's important, like, to be able to say no, especially if you think it's something that you just wouldn't nail as a project. Like, because you want everything you produce to be as good as it can be to your current skill level, right? Like what you're making today, I'm sure, is better than it was 12 months ago, and in 12 months' time it will be different again, right? So
yeah,
you want to give it your absolute best, whatever it is that you're working on, you know. And so yeah, I can imagine there would be times when some people, you know, working artists, and I'm thinking particularly of people that might be stepping into the sphere of becoming a working artist, you know, at the early stages of that, not having done it for 20 years, might feel like they should accept every offer that comes their way because, like, the world tells us, I guess capitalism, the world tells us we need money, like.
Yeah.
But yes. it's not always a good idea, I don't think.
No, there's not. I mean, like, at the end of the day, we all need to eat and pay our bills and pay our rent, but we've also got to sleep with ourselves at night. And
yeah,
I'm just one of those people. I can't lay my head down on the pillow at night and sit with something that I am at odds with. I'm just not that person. So, I mean, each person's different and you've got to, you know, make the best decision that works for you. But, I mean, at this point in my career, I certainly feel like I have more of a luxury to say no sometimes to those sorts of jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. Has there been, like, if you look over your body of work, what stands out? Like, is there one specific piece that is everything that you want it to be? And you know, like, it's just like, yeah, this is like the gold standard, the, like, you know, the whatever.
Mm.
Or is there a favorite that may not actually be gold standard, if you want to call it that, but for whatever reason speaks to you more than anything else?
That's a good question, because I don't know if many other creatives feel this way as well, but I kind of do. I'm not going to call it imposter syndrome, because it's not, I don't view it as a negative thing, but I just feel like I've never arrived and I've never reached my full creative potential or created something that I feel is, this is the magnum opus and showcases skills that I want to showcase, and then the messaging and then the aesthetics, and it's all just working together like 10 out of 10. I definitely want to change up my creative practice over the next year or two to incorporate more analog elements again, and incorporate resin and do split level stuff where I reintroduce the pointillism, and then with the mixed media stuff as well. This is probably making no sense, but I want to be able to answer this question again in maybe 2 years or 3 years time and be like, you know what? Yes, I have. But like, over the last 10 years since I've been doing it professionally, there's been a few that I really genuinely love, and I feel like, oh, it, when you just in your sweet spot creatively and you just know that you've created something that's so authentically you, that's an amazing feeling. And I've done that a few times. There's been a couple of pop culture ones and a few political ones that are really important to me. So I'm always chasing that next piece that I hope can sort of land in that sort of area.
Given that you do work currently digitally, do you have, and it can be large or small or whatever, have everything that has become a piece of work and piece of artwork is it all available to you, like in your home, I'm thinking, as a print, or do you just like create it, decide what becomes product and whatnot, but don't necessarily, because I'm imagining your Procreate album, file, whatever we want to call them, the name escapes me, sorry. Do you, like, I imagine that's got a lot in it. Do you have a physical copy of all of the stuff? Do you know what I mean? Like,
I've got a backup of all the files and
okay, yes. good. And that's
I've got,
that's
and
good.
And in my storeroom, I've got like I've kept all the sketches and all the drafts and all the unfinished ones that I sketched and everything. Yes, so I try and hold on to as much of it as I can. Yeah,
But that's the thing, working digitally, like it's great because you have. Yeah. Especially when you're working on an iPad, for example, because you can, you know, essentially have not unlimited canvases, but let's just say that for the sake of the argument. But then you don't necessarily have the physical product. Like, and that's why for me as a photographer, I'm really, really keen on printing photos because I think for me, that's the end game of the actual taking of the photo is to have a physical thing. And I realize a good chunk of that is my age. I'm 48. I grew up with film, like, you know, so I know that's not necessarily everybody's bag, but I can imagine there would be people that have learnt to make art or gotten better or really good at art on their digital device, whether it's an iPad or whatever, and don't even have a physical version of it.
Yeah.
Which kind of seems a bit sad and weird and strange.
Yeah, I mean, it depends as well, like, what your goals are. If you do it just for the process or if you do it because you want a particular outcome to admire and dwell on and enjoy. Certainly, like, opening up our physical shop allowed me to do that. So I was actually, you know, getting the art prints made and framed up and on other products as well. And I was just like, oh, it's nice to be surrounded by these tangible physical things that I'm so used to just seeing on a screen.
Yeah. And do you find... like, is the making sure of things such as colour that is on the screen coming through to the actual physical product, so the printing of, like, is that process, the printing of the work onto product, is that a really difficult thing to nail down to get that right?
It's been a huge learning curve. Like, certainly when I first started and I was just doing pointillism, which is all just the black ink portraiture, that was a really steep learning curve as it translates to printing, because you'd be drawing these faces and because you've used so much ink and there's so many, you know, potentially over a million dots on this one piece, to sort of translate that on ink on like fabric or something is really tricky. So I'd had to almost switch up my technique just to be a bit more light-handed and allow there to be more light than dark, and then shifting to the digital brush as well, just seeing like how different skin tones even like translate onto print, and how I've been just cooling off my palettes a little bit because I've just noticed how they do tend to translate physically on products. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah, I mean, I look at how I printed something 3 or 4 years ago to now and like absolutely cringe and want to go back and just like restart like a lot of the old ones that are still selling. I'm just like, no, this is all wrong. But it's a constant learning journey for sure.
But I guess the thing with the older products that now you feel are wrong, like everybody's used to them being like that, right? And I can imagine if you change something up, there might even be outrage. Like, how dare it go from being this to that?
I just quietly hope that no one would notice. And it's just so that I'm looking at it going, yes, now it's right. But yeah, I've got one that's popping up again and I keep on seeing it and I could kind of die on the inside because I'm just like, oh my God, choices. I would have done so many things differently, but that's just part of it. And it does make you just take stock of, oh, cool, I've grown and, you know, I've developed my skill sets and I'm glad I see things in a different way now and I can, you know, do better.
Yeah, and I think it's fascinating you mention that because I don't think enough people do that, stop and look back at where they've come. Like, honestly, what are we now? It might as well be December as we're recording this, right? Like, it's the 26th of November. Even if we were to step back and look at ourselves in January and what we were producing then to what now, I'm sure it's changed and improved and gotten better. But I just don't feel like we do enough. And I'm not talking about nasal gazing for the sake of it, like, but like actually Do you know what? Being a cheerleader for yourself and saying, hey, I can now, those shadows are now more realistic, or, you know, my brush technique is better. Like, there's so many different things that I think in a way we absorb and it's really good and our skills improve, but we don't necessarily stop to recognize that.
Definitely. And because I still sell prints that I illustrated like 8 years ago or so, it's glaringly obvious every day when I see them pop up and I look at them on the screen. I'm just like, yeah, that one. I've changed quite a bit, but it's good. It's good. And it makes me, you know, optimistic that, you know, that will continue. And in a few years' time, I'll be able to look back to 2025 and go like, oh, gee, I've really turned a corner with that particular, you know, skill set or challenge. So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It is good to improve and but also to know, I guess it's never stop learning, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think when you first start and you can feel a little bit confident for a while, I think that's not the best place to be in. Again, depending on what your goals are, I think it's very healthy to sit with some older stuff and really think very critically about your process and your craft. Because I don't think we should be staying the same. I think it's always important to be challenging ourselves and, yeah, push yourself a little bit.
Definitely. And I also find I sometimes will go back through old sketchbooks, even old photos, and realize I think part of it is I'm just very harsh on myself, like I'm a really bad to myself. But I'll look back at stuff and go, oh, that wasn't as bad as I remember. Like, that's actually not bad. Like, that's you know what I mean? And it's just like,
I was cooking that day. Yeah.
Yeah. And then why did I not recognize it? Why did I say I was the worst painter in the world? And like, do you know what I mean?
For sure. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, gosh. So you mentioned Procreate in the iPad. If somebody wants to begin with those as a creative outlet, what kind of suggestions would you have for them? Especially factoring in your analog work prior to then flipping to digital.
Good question. I suppose as well, like, it does depend on what they want to be actually illustrating as well. I mean, I immediately just fell in love with Procreate. I just found it incredibly powerful and elegant and was just so impressed with it. And also just enjoyed the freedom of being able to have, as you said, like 1,000 canvases and be able to make a few more mistakes and be a bit more daring with color because you can just so quickly erase it digitally. You can really feel a lot more emboldened to be a bit more daring. But for me, I love tone and texture. So spend some time finding like some brush sets that really spoke to me. And just have fun, experiment, play, but also think critically about it as well. And by all means, like I keep, when people ask me, you know, I'm starting art, what should I do? How should I find a style? Or and just, you know, just start. Even though I'm a big Pinterest hoe. I love Pinterest. I love a Pinterest board. Just save some pins of some pieces that really speak to you, that you feel probably sit within a similar vein, and then come back to them and then just think critically about what is drawing me to these pieces, and think very specifically about it as well. Like, get academic on it, you know, and break apart all the components, and then feel free to borrow some of those approaches or perspectives and then inject yourself into it and just see what feels at home for you. Yeah.
And I think also remember that style comes. It's not like a lot of people are sort of like, how do I find my style? And in a way, I don't think you do. I think your style finds you. And I think it can change over time as well.
Oh, definitely.
You know, that's the other thing. And I think sometimes, especially for newer artists, you know, it just even wanting to just have some downtime every day and spend 20 minutes drawing. Don't worry about your style. Just get to the, like, do we do the art for the art's sake, I think.
Exactly.
Is way more important. Yeah.
You'll know when you're in your sweet spot because it'll feel damn good.
Yes. And you'll find yourself, well, I know I do, not wanting to do anything else. Like you forget the time in a way. You know, it's like you, I guess you're in the flow and you're just.
Get in that flow. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Making the art for the art's sake.
Definitely.
One thing I think, and we've kind of only lightly touched on, which is sort of your work does touch on political and what's the current events, like, isn't quite the right
issues.
Thanks. Yep. Thank you. Because clearly my brain is gone. How do you find balancing not being preachy, I guess, with getting the point across? Like, is it a hard thing to do?
I'm conscious of that. I think especially because I feel we're living in times where there's never been, I feel, a more of a divide. People are very isolated and very tribal. And so when you want to speak up about a particular issue, it can be a challenge to not come across as being, you know, like a woke scold or something. I find being able to inject a bit of humor is the best way to sort of subvert that or to avoid that, rather. I think humor is one of the most powerful tools to speak truth to power and to sort of expose something for what it really is in a very disarming way. And so, yeah, I'd say if I can find a humorous route to take, I'll probably take it over something that's just black and white, like, I don't like this and I'm making this look bad, you know. I want to have sort of a bit more nuance and a specific point of view to bring to the table as opposed to just, this is my side of the aisle and this is what I believe and therefore I'm just saying this and it's really obvious and you'll either like it or hate it. I prefer sometimes almost starting a little conversation and making people just pause for a moment so that it's, not so rigid.
Well, that's what I was actually going to say. Yeah, it does. Yeah, I was going to say that. It feels like it invites a conversation. And I wonder if part of that is because it is art. Like, it, in a way, art probably, I mean, the humour, of course, but, like, the art eases someone into the conversation, maybe? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I just feel like that kind of is what's happened, or what happens is, especially, you know, like, I can think of, I have a very, very good friend. She lives in America and, of course, she is absolutely devastated with what's going on, and we won't get too political because I know I shouldn't. But, you know, I don't even think I need to say anything more because I think people know where I stand on all that. But something she has been taking great pleasure in is purchasing T-shirts similar to like what you do. So T-shirts from artists, small indie artists that have got a lot of what she buys is, I'm thinking cartoon character type drawings, although they're not anyone recognizable. It's not Mickey Mouse or any of that sort of stuff, but, you know, cartoony type creations. And then with some kind of sassy comment, you know, wording that's, but it's in beautiful rainbow colors, for example. And she takes great pleasure in wearing that because she's like, she has had some people, like most of the time, if the people she's passing by, let's say, or at a cafe, don't agree with what she's wearing, they'll just give her the dirty eye and, you know, continue on. Yeah. But she has had a couple of people actually engage. And it's brought a conversation on, which I think is such a powerful thing, right, that this piece of artwork, which in her case and certainly for you with your artwork, is being worn by somebody, can invite a conversation, which is really powerful.
Oh, definitely. I have so many messages from people who say they wear a lot of my, you know, socially, politically bold prints on their body around and get start so many conversations with people. And it also, I've had a lot of people say they've had amazing feedback from people. If it's speaking to a particular social issue, it invites a sense of flagging to someone, like a stranger in public, like, you're not alone, you know, I'm standing with you.
Yes.
And I've had people, because I will sometimes have some T-shirts hanging in the shop window that look out onto, because we're next to a cafe and there's a little courtyard. So everyone who's sitting having their breakfast can see the shop doorway with the t-shirts in it. And sometimes there's more controversial ones than others. And I've had people come and go, I'm just so glad that that t-shirt was in the window. I feel seen and I feel safe. Or I think it's important that these conversations are normalized in the public square and we should feel like we can talk about this stuff. And so that's really beneficial too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I think too, it often feels like the loudest voices are the ones that, quite frankly, don't need the voice and not necessarily on the side of good, for want of a better term. Do you know what I mean? So to have that ability for people to be wearing something, and even if two people pass by, one wearing the shirt, the other one, they don't necessarily have to say a word to each other, but they clock that person respects me. And you know what I mean? Like, I think that's in as much power as stopping and having a conversation. Like, that's also pretty important.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. We all have the opportunity to be our own little billboard every day for whatever purpose we decide. And yeah, it can be a beautiful thing for people to find each other in public spaces in that sort of way. Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I think I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that I want to sort of talk to you about, but I feel like we've covered a lot and it's been a really good conversation. I mean, I got to pick your brain and find out why you opened a store, which is just such a wonderful thing.
Because it sounds insane in 2025, because all the ones around us are like shutting down and it's just like, oh God. But
well, that's what I thought when I saw the whenever it was that you initially announced it, I'm like, he's what now? They're what now? Like, because it just feels crazy. Like it does. I think it also feels from an outsider, I realize this is just me, but like it feels like a bigger decision now than maybe it used to be when we weren't necessarily as online as we are now.
Definitely. I mean, I had a lot of people just kind of like giving me the side eye, like, oh wow, he's getting brave. But it complements what we do online. Like, we probably wouldn't do it if we didn't already have what we have online as well to complement it all. But it has also just added another dimension to what we do. And we get so many people coming in who are just so happy that they have an eclectic, unique shop to purchase something special for someone they love from. That's not mass produced. It's not sit down in like 1,000 other shops or mass produced online somewhere. There's real value in that people really see. And so I think that's definitely a thread that's been keeping us going is that we've got an amazing community of people who really value what we bring to the community. And as I said before, it's amazing to be able to like to connect with them as well. So
yeah, definitely. Actually, I did think of one more thing that I would be like terrible to not ask is, where does the name Naudacious come from?
Well, it turns out there's a lot of famous James Hilliers. None of which would probably come to your mind immediately, but a lot of all those handles that were taken a long time ago. And so I needed to come up with a silly little online username back in the day. And so Naudacious comes from partly Nord, which was, I'm a musician too, and I play keyboard. Mm-hmm. So I've always loved my Nord synthesizer.
Okay, good.
And I was also really into Nordic music as well, like Sigur Rós. A lot of that really ethereal, wintery stuff. And at the time as well, I wanted to put myself out there. This is like over a decade ago now. And I wanted to be more audacious. And so my creativity was my platform for that boldness. And so I just smashed those two together and just got Naudacious. And when I first started, I changed everything to James Hillier Art and everyone's like, no, you need to stay as Naudacious. So I was like, gotta get the people what they want.
I'm glad you did, but I've got to say, I'm surprised you're into such cold music when you live in Queensland. Like, really? Or is that why? Is it the opposite?
That's I was not biologically engineered to live in this humid climate at all. So yeah, winter's always been on my mind. Yes.
Okay, all right. I'll accept that.
I'm sitting inside right now with like two fans on me and the air conditioning, and
you can't survive Australian summers without it. It's just like damn near impossible. Yeah.
Yes.
James, thank you so much again for taking time out. This has been such a great conversation. Just before we wrap, where is the best place for listeners to find you?
Yeah, so I'm on pretty much every social media platform, just at Naudacious, and my website is naudacious.com.
Fantastic, James. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure.
Would you be interested in making a one-off payment to support us? In return, you'd be helping to keep the podcast going and would also get access to our bonus episodes. Let me know what you think via kim@artsupplyposse.com or via Instagram.
Okay, we got that. With no dog barking, I am happy.